Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
TF Common Audit Report Application and Remote Auditing Webinar. My name is Joseph Krolikowski. I am a veto power reviewer for PJR, and I'm going to be walking you through these new items. Couple of notes for everyone. All of our participants today are on mute, but we absolutely want to address your questions, so please utilize the question portion of the dashboard. We will address your questions at the end of the presentation. Now, our presentation today is going to cover two topics kind of in succession. We're going to start with CARA. We're going to talk about what is CARA, how does it work. We're going to address how CARA is going to impact the audit process, including probably the most important impact, that being the nonconformance process. And we're going to give you some tips for learning a little bit more about CARA. And then from there, we're going to shift gears and go into remote auditing. And we're going to talk about policies pertaining to remote audits under IETF, how you qualify for an IETF remote audit. We'll have some in-depth discussion on a couple of key items, audit coordinators and technology test sessions, and what happens if something goes wrong. After those items are finished, we'll have some concluding remarks, and then we will address your questions. So let's begin with CARA. CARA stands for Common Audit Report Application, and this was released by the IETF in the fall, and it has been positioned as a means of ensuring consistency in the completion and reporting of IETF audits. CARA is going to become mandatory in just a couple of weeks. It'll be mandatory on January 1st of 2021. Now, the structure of CARA, it includes all of the audit types that are listed in the Rules 5th edition. So it covers stage one, readiness reviews, stage two, surveillance recert, and even special audits. Now, when CARA was under development, there was some speculation at that time that it would resemble the OASIS database used by the aerospace industry. And that may have been an interesting idea, but ultimately that was not what was presented when CARA was released. CARA is not a database. There is no centralized database for IETF audit reports. It is a web browser-based audit reporting tool. Every auditor and every certification body is given unique credentials to access CARA and then to create and edit audit content. Now, any content that is created in that way, it resides on the user's web browser until such time as it is outputted in one or more of the possible formats. And I'll be giving a little clarification on that in just a few slides. Now, from your perspective, as an auditee, you're obviously wondering, well, is the audit process going to be any different under CARA? Our belief at PJR, and this has been expressed by the IETF as well, is that the overall audit process is going to feel no different as a result of CARA being deployed. Now, there is one particular change in terms of the audit process that we did want to make you aware of. They've issued a sanction interpretation, which sanction interpretations are public domain. If you go to the IETF website, you can download a copy for yourself. And this sanction interpretation, which is number 16, indicates that the auditors can now allocate up to 15% of their on-site time to report writing. Now, previously, that had been a 10% maximum. So obviously, if you have a multiple day audit, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 15% can kind of add up. So you may start to see larger chunks of time being assigned for auditor report writing. Now, the big change in terms of clients is going to be responding to nonconformances. So as I've mentioned, the process for performing the audits is going to feel exactly the same, but this is obviously a post-audit activity, responding to the nonconformances. Now, currently, if you're a PJR client, which you're probably accustomed to, is receiving a file. This is typically going to be a Microsoft Word file, either through email or a flash drive from your auditor. This file includes all the nonconformances. You then use that file to document your responses to those nonconformances and then email that back to your auditor with the evidence attached. Now, under CARA, the principles of those steps are going to be the same, but the methodology has been changed. So let's go over what the steps are going to be kind of piece by piece. Now, at the end of the audit, just prior to your closing meeting, you should expect your auditor to prepare your nonconformances within the CARA application. And those are then going to be given to you, again, possibly through email or a flash drive, with the nonconformances housed in what's called a JSON file, a JSON file. I've got an example down here of how that type of email might look. Now, depending on the number of nonconformances, the auditor may opt to give you a single JSON file that has all of the nonconformances in one place, or multiple JSON files where you have a separate file for each individual nonconformance. And obviously, you can request either one depending on your preference. Now, you'll need to remember that the JSON file itself cannot be opened or manipulated outside of CARA. If you attempt to double click on it, you're going to get an error message. Now, what you should do when you get that JSON file is go to the designated CARA website for IETF clients. And I've got the URL here. It's nc-cara.ietfglobaloversight.org. Now, when you go onto that website, you'll go down to the bottom of the page. You're going to find a field entitled Data Management, and you're going to click where it says Load Report Backup. I've got it highlighted for you on the screen, and you will load the JSON file that the auditor provided you. Now, once that JSON file has been loaded, you'll be able to respond to the nonconformances by clicking on the edit icon. Now, the edit icon is on the far right. I've got it highlighted here. And if you click on that, you'll be able to open up the nonconformance and see all of the content. Now, the first thing that you should do when you are in the edit mode on the nonconformance is review the auditor's finding. You should review the statement of nonconformity, the evidence of nonconformity, and the requirement. Now, if any part of that is inaccurate or misconstrued, it's very important that you notify your auditor as soon as possible, because these things need to be corrected. Obviously, the findings need to be accurate and reflect what was agreed to during the audit itself. Now, obviously, if you don't agree with the nonconformance and everything has been clarified, but you still don't agree with it, bear in mind that you can file a dispute. But if you're going to do that, you need to do so within 15 calendar days from the conclusion of the audit. Now, assuming that the nonconformance is understood and agreed to, you are then going to be required to provide your response. And the response has been broken up into a number of separate pieces. And I want to walk you through each and every one of these. The first field that you're going to hit is called correction or containment. Now, this has got to include timing and who's responsible and so forth. Bear in mind that this is acting against the evidence that was stated in the nonconformance. So, you know, for example, if the auditor's nonconformance is that a training record was not provided, well, your correction is going to be the creation of that training record. We actually have a whole separate presentation on how to properly respond to nonconformances. If you've not gone through that before, I definitely recommend it. Now, I want to point out, very importantly, under this correction containment field, this is where you are going to be expected to capture your extent analysis also. This is a very key item for IETF audit nonconformances. Remember that when you correct an issue, part of the expectation is that you are doing the horizontal analysis, the read across, making sure that you are addressing any similar situations. So again, this correction containment field should capture both the correction for the item cited by the auditor and any extent analysis that you did. Now, the next field that you hit after correction containment is called evidence of implementation. And it seems intuitive that you would attach a file to this item here. That's actually not the intent. This is a field where you are asked to describe the evidence that you're providing. IETF is very specific in that you are expected to provide evidence for your correction actions and evidence for your corrective actions also. Now, there's actually a whole separate evidence of implementation field a little bit later for corrective action, as we'll see. There's two of these. So when you're filling in evidence of implementation, let's go back to our example and say that your correction was to create the training record for the employee in question. Under evidence of implementation, you would say, see attached training record 1234 for employee XYZ. You'll describe the implementation evidence that you're providing. Now, from there, there are actually four separate fields that are dedicated to the root cause step. And they begin with root cause analysis. Now, this is actually a new item in spite of the name. And what's intended to be captured here is not so much the root cause result, but rather the analysis of cause, the process that you followed in arriving at the cause. Those of you that are familiar with 5-Y cause analysis or cause effect diagrams or things of this nature, you'll recognize that this is a process kind of for working your way through to figure out what the cause is. Now, if you have supporting files for this, fishbone diagrams and so forth, the next field, the root cause analysis files field, can be used. That is an optional field. Ultimately, the agreed upon cause is captured in root cause result. This is the final established cause for the cited issue. And if you happen to have a support file for the root cause result as well, there is a separate place for that to be provided also. Now, from there, we move into corrective action. And we actually have, this is one place where there's a little bit of overkill in terms of what was provided. So we have some very specific advice for you here. First of all, your corrective action, systemic corrective action. Again, you're expected to state what your corrective action is. You need to provide timing and who's responsible. Now, from there, there's a field entitled Systemic Corrective Action Files. Now, our official advice to you, based on our discussion with the IAOB, is that you skip that field. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. Skip down then to our second evidence of implementation field. So again, this is going to be specifically for the corrective action portion of your response. And again, the intent is that you are going to describe the evidence that you are providing that correlates to your corrective action. So, you know, if your corrective action was that you've written a procedure for a particular activity, your evidence of implementation should give us the name and number of that new procedure, so that it's very easy and straightforward for the auditor and for PJR to make sense of what's been provided. Oftentimes, when we get a corrective action response from a client, there are numerous pieces of attached evidence, and it can be difficult at times to make sense of what's been presented. So this is intended to address that, this evidence of implementation field. And again, recognize that there are two of these. One for any correction evidence, this one for corrective action evidence. Okay. The next field after that is called evidence of implementation files. Now, this is the field that we recommend you use in terms of providing attachments. Now, CARA does support putting actual evidence into the application, but there are only two file types that it will support, and these are JPEG picture files and Adobe PDF files. Now, if you have additional evidence pieces, if you have Word files or Excel or PowerPoint or other items, those cannot be uploaded to CARA, but they can absolutely be provided to your auditor via email or through other appropriate steps. Now, please note that those items still have to be described in the evidence of implementation field. This is part of why that evidence of implementation field is there. So you're going to describe, here's all the evidence that we have to support our correction and to support our corrective action. And then you're either going to attach that evidence right into CARA, or if it's not a supported file type, you're going to email it to the auditor. That's the intent. The final things that you need to fill out relate to verification of effective implementation. You will, first of all, describe the action that you took to verify the effective implementation of your corrective action, whether that was a follow-up audit or a follow-up meeting or whatever the case may be. And then there is a separate verify effective implementation of corrective action files field. And this, again, can be used to provide evidence to support your verification actions. That is an optional field. Now, once you have inputted all of the required information, you're going to use the Save NCs for Auditor button to create your own JSON file. And I've got the button kind of highlighted here on the screen. You're going to output your own JSON file and send that back to the auditor for review and approval. Now, we recommend that you also utilize the Print Report button to output a PDF file for your own records. That's right next to the Save NCs for Auditor. Now, one thing I'm going to recommend while you're filling in this information, look for the mandatory fields as you're filling in your response. These are things where required content has to be provided in order for the report to be complete. So if you get to the bottom of the page and you click Save NCs for Auditor, if you haven't provided everything, you are going to get an error message. You would then scroll back up and look for the red outlined boxes, just like the ones I've got shown here at the bottom of the screen. If you've not provided a piece of information that's required, you're going to get an error message when you attempt to save the work that you've done. Now, if the auditor or the veto reviewer finds a concern with one or more of the responses that you've provided, These are going to be outlined in the reviewer comments field, as shown below here. Now, these comments are going to be then shared with you via an updated JSON file that'll be shared through the same process prior discussed. So if the initial response is unacceptable, it's going to be recorded here. This will be sent back to you, updated JSON file. You'll go through, you'll provide the updates that are needed and push this thing through until it is fully accepted. Now, after the final approval by the reviewer, you should expect to receive a finalized JSON file showing the approval for your records. Now, in the past, we had a few of our ITF clients that had a preference for using their own corrective action format to record their responses. That allowance, unfortunately, will not be permitted under the CARA system. You can definitely use your internal process for developing your response, for working your way through the process. But in terms of officially submitting those responses, that has to be done via the CARA application. That is the ITF's requirement. Now, the ITF has developed a wiki information page for clients with some further details and actually a very helpful tutorial video. The wiki page can be accessed at the link below. And that can be also accessed directly from the CARA page itself. So, if you go to nc-cara.itfglobaloversight.org, this link is provided there as well. So, with that, let's turn our attention over to remote auditing. And let's begin with where the policies come from for remote auditing. Excuse me. Now, obviously, this is being driven by the COVID-19 pandemic. And throughout the pandemic, the ITF has maintained a document titled ITF Global Waivers and Measures in Response to the Coronavirus Pandemic. Now, this document is public domain. If you want to get your hands on it, it's available for free from the ITF website. I'm going to be referring to this document extensively through the presentation as the IATF COVID memo. So, one of the questions that we've been getting is, why did this take so long? When the pandemic was first declared back in early 2020, there were industries that were very quick to jump on remote auditing, and there were some others that were initially reluctant to embrace remote auditing. And the automotive industry ended up being the most stubborn of the holdouts. Now, their logic was that remote auditing techniques, they felt that they would not constitute an effective audit. And, you know, they were suspicious whether or not this could be effective. So they finally, you know, there was some increasing pressure. There was some, I believe, threats of legal action. And the ITF changed their stance. And so they announced back in late October that remote audits would finally be accepted. Now, obviously, the intent is that this is going to be for any situation where there is a concern over COVID. Going forward, and especially post-pandemic, the ITF has made it very clear that remote audits will not be acceptable as a auditing technique for the ITF 16949 standard. And that's actually baked right into the COVID memo. It says that in order for this to be justified, it has to be, as they say, demonstrably evident that a regular on-site audit will not be possible for reasons directly linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. So obviously, if you are in the midst of a government lockdown, And persons are not allowed to travel or work outside of the home. If you have a no visitors policy for concerns over COVID-19 exposure and so forth. These are the types of reasonings that are considered acceptable to qualify for an IATF remote audit. Now, if you are in a place where you need to request a remote audit, what you need to do first is contact your PJR scheduler and explain what your reasoning is for requesting a remote audit. You're then going to be sent a form entitled the F108 ICT IATF or IATF Remote Audit Questionnaire. Now, this form, it's a rather detailed form. It's intended to make sure that PJR is meeting all requirements from the IATF COVID memo, specifically Annex A, subclause section 1.2, and a portion of the memo that relates to audit planning. Section 1.2 talks about the need for a documented agreement between PJR and the client with regards to the remote audit. So what I want to do over the next several slides here, I'd like to explore the content of the F108 ICT IATF and give you some insight into why we're asking the things that we're asking. So to begin with, we have some questions that pertain to software and hardware covering the technical aspects. Now, in terms of software, we have licenses for GoToMeeting here at PJR. If you're looking for PJR to provide a resource for performing the remote audit, we have arrangements with GoToMeeting. Now, if you have preferences on using Microsoft Teams or Skype for Business or Zoom, etc., those are absolutely permitted. But if you choose to utilize those alternatives, it's understood that it is your responsibility to make sure they are successfully utilized. Now, in terms of hardware, understand that hardware needs to be sufficiently broad that it is going to encompass both the office areas of your business and also the production areas. You know, you need to think in terms of not just a conference room setup, but things like cell phones, body cameras, and so forth, in order to facilitate the audit. Now, the IATF's requirement is still that all production areas across all shifts have to be included in the audit process. That has not changed as a result of the adoption of remote auditing. So, you know, among other things, there has to be sufficient Wi-Fi or cellular signal strength to permit real-time auditor review of the production areas. There's a question that pertains to your ability to support a remote audit. And what we're asking for essentially is, are all or even most of your records maintained in an electronic state such that it is seamless for us to review them in a remote setting? Now, we do have certain flexibility in this area in terms of, you know, if you're going to be scanning records and so forth. But bear in mind that these have to be requested by the auditor. So if we don't permit a pre-selecting or a pre-screening of evidence items, the auditor must be the one picking the audit samples at all times. Now, from there, we go into some question as to whether or not you are actively manufacturing your product and expect to be doing so during the audit. It is mandatory the production be included in the audit process. So if there's going to be a shutdown, that needs to be regarded with concern, and we're going to have to take some additional consideration of that matter. Now, from there, questions 5 through 10, these all relate to gathering information so that we can make sure that the audit time is going to be sufficient and also to enable our auditor or our audit team to be able to effectively plan. So let's go through what these items are. To To begin with, questions 5 through 7 all pertain to whether or not you had a shutdown. And if you did have a shutdown, we want to know how long were you shut down? When were you shut down? And what were the startup verification plans that you followed after you resumed operations? Question 8 talks about any extraordinary measures that you had to take. Was it necessary for you to outsource manufacturing? If that was the case, the auditor is going to potentially have to review what the arrangements were with your external provider and whether or not you secured customer approvals for that arrangement. Question 9 talks about resources that have been lost. This may have some impact on customer scorecards, KPIs, and so forth. Question 10 talks about changes to your day-to-day protocols, again, with an eye towards audit planning. Now, question 11 is a rather important question. It asks about an audit coordinator. Now, this is a specific designation from the COVID memo, and it reads as follows. Now, this coordinator manages connections, availability of auditees, and manages technical issues throughout the entire audit. It may be necessary to have more than one coordinator, especially if there is more than one CB auditor, with parallel audits being conducted simultaneously. Now, the COVID memo goes on to say that the certification body shall ensure that the audit team maintains full control of the audit steps and discussion to ensure the coordinator is not responding for the auditees. In general, you can think of the audit coordinator along the same lines as what we call a guide during the on-site audit, and therefore subject to the same bylaws that are applied for guides by both the IETF and the ISO 17021-1 standard. Question 12 talks about what is referred to as a technology test session. And this is actually yet another item mandated by the IETF COVID memo, where it states that a technology test session must be performed between the client and audit team prior to the audit for all technology types to be used in the context of the audit. Now, I want to point out, very important, this is to be done between the client and the audit team, not the client and PJR, because we're not going to be the ones performing the remote audit. Now, the final portion of the F108 ICT IETF asks you to indicate who your automotive customers are and indicate if they are operational or not. And this is also then geared towards appropriate audit planning. So there's two things in this paperwork that I want to spend a few extra minutes on to make sure the points are very clear. Let's start with the audit coordinator. Now, the audit coordinator should be someone that is reasonably versed in the technical aspects of the remote interface, someone that can work with the software, someone that can work with the hardware, to help make sure that the audit, the remote audit, is going smoothly. But they cannot interject themselves into the audit interviews or attempt to select samples or interviewees on the auditor's behalf. The auditor has to maintain control of the audit at all times. So this might be a team of people. This might be the quality system coordinator and a member of the IT department working together as the audit coordinator. Now, let's also revisit this idea of the technology test session. And I really want to emphasize this point. The verbiage from the COVID memo states that this needs to include all areas associated with the audit. So all support locations, you know, if your IETF system includes a manufacturing site and two remote sales offices, Well, that test session has to include both of the remote sales offices. It has to include all production areas. So if you've got a large manufacturing area with 25 machines, you need to be reasonably inclusive in going around the shop and making sure that the remote interface is working properly. All administrative areas, all technology types. You know, you can't just test the conference room computer. If you're intending to use the conference room computer plus two other computers and a tablet, you need to test all four of those items. And you need to test backups also. If your backup for the tablet is a cell phone, then the test session needs to include both the tablet and the cell phone. Basically, there needs to be a reasonable assurance that the remote audit is going to be successful. That's the intent of this test session. And the test session needs to be conducted in advance of the audit. It is considered a separate activity. Now, if some part of the remote audit doesn't work, you know, in spite of our best efforts to plan and have advanced testing, obviously it is possible that some part of it may not work, and therefore some part of the audit is not completed. The COVID memo says that if any part of the audit cannot be successfully completed as planned, the time that has been lost is going to be added to a subsequent audit. So here's how PJR has deployed this requirement. If we are performing a surveillance audit, in most cases, we are going to be adding time to the next audit. Whatever time was lost will get added to the next audit. Now, if the remote audit in question is a stage two or a recertification audit, and I'll mention that a majority of our clients are going to be going through recertification audits in 2021 because of the 3-year cycle, what is going to most likely happen is we're going to be working with a second supplemental assessment to make up the difference in lost audit time to ensure that all of the processes are covered across all shifts. Now, obviously, not everyone is fully comfortable with a remote audit, and not everyone can support it in terms of having soft records and so forth. Now, the prior versions of the COVID memo had provisions for delaying audits in excess of the permitted timeframes. Now, those extensions, unfortunately, are no longer available in the current version of the memo. So, in essence, you must have your audit done, whether on-site or virtually, in accordance with the required time frame, or you risk losing your certification. So if you are one of these companies where there is a number of hard copy records, you may have to put some time into transitioning at least some of those records to a virtual medium, whether this is scanning or otherwise, as part of your preparation for the audit. PJR will certainly work with you as best we are able. Now, I want to assure you, we are a tenured provider of remote audits. We've been doing remote audits since early March, and at this point have performed well in excess of over 1,000 of these remote audits for a variety of schemes with great success. If you want to learn a little more about our remote audit process, I would encourage you to check out our webinar entitled Virtual Audits Explaining PJR's Approach and Expectations. And speaking of webinars, in addition to our virtual audits webinar, I'd like to also invite you to check out one of our other webinars. We have a very popular webinar on the interaction of processes and its importance to a successful audit. This one is shown on a semi-annual basis. This is an exploration of the topic of processes and how to correctly understand them. And we have webinars on a lot of other things too. Stage one auditing, a variety of standards. We have a webinar on statutory regulatory requirements. Lots of great content. We'd love to have you join us. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to go to our website at www.pjr.com. If you go to the bottom of the page, enter your email address and click subscribe, you'll be opted in for the latest updates automatically. I do thank you for your time. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and unlock the questions portion of the dashboard and see if any of our attendees have questions for me today. Again, as a reminder, this webinar will be posted to our YouTube page shortly after we're finished, and we'll be putting the slides up for download on our website shortly after we're finished here. Okay, it would appear we have no questions today, so I'll bid you all a very happy holiday season, and thank you for your attendance.